Okay, so short unit due to Veterans Day. So only one half of this unit, just because there are some cultural sensitivities to snakes. There will be some snakes. Just mentioning there will be some snakes discussed in this lecture. Not this though. This is not a snake, which will be a given point of this lecture. Otherwise, there's only one lecture in this unit. Then there will be a perusal assignment. And a Canvas exercise due this Sunday, this upcoming Sunday, just in a couple of days on this unit. Remember that these comprehension assignments, the lowest five are dropped here. So, it's not a lot of time, but you can kind of figure out the balance there. Group project feedback is coming back. The TAs have been working on that and been giving you guys feedback on those projects and how you're doing, the organisms you've picked, the questions, the feasibility, and so on. Your next deliverables are the last week of classes. So the Wednesday of the last week of classes, right in the middle of it, we have the presentation upload. So that's, a 10-minute presentation or less, that where you kind of give your pitch as if you were proposing a research project to study this issue. And in that pitch, framed in that pitch, it should be clear what your kind of causal question is, your hypotheses, the experiment you're predicting, and if you did that experiment, what predictions would flow down from that hypothesis. So thus testing your hypothesis by doing the experiment by testing agreement with the prediction. So that's what you should be working on towards that presentation. And then once you upload that in the middle of that week, so let's do the Wednesday of that, then every individual student will be assigned one presentation to watch. And then to fill out a rubric and to leave some comments on that. So that will be the kind of peer review. So you don't present them in class, they're presented by upload, and then you watch one of them. And so that ensures that roughly three or four people will watch every video. So there'll be three or four peer reviews for every video. And then I will take a look at all those peer reviews, and that helps me determine how to modulate the score based on how your peers responded to your argument. So that's what's going on here. Any questions about everything moving forward? Yeah, that's the idea, is that you'll be assigned these peer reviews after Wednesday here, and then that Thursday will be stage one of the final exam. So you'll have until Saturday. See Saturday last week of classes to get those peer reviews in. So that's the idea, is that you're assigned the video, and then on your own time you can watch the video. Should be, again, 10-minute video or less, and then you'll fill out a rubric, which I provided as part of the peer review assignment, and provide a little bit of constructive feedback. And if you do the peer review, the numeric review, as well as provide constructive feedback, then I'll give you your peer review credit. And that goes into the total score for your final project. So the final project is mostly a group project, but there's this tiny little peer review credit, which just checks that you've done your peer review. Other questions about that? Yep. The feedback for this should come back. I think it's probably not. I don't know if we've been posting it as we've been leaving it. We could do that, but once all the grades are in and the grades are posted, then it should be like you get feedback from any other assignment. So if you go in the grade book, click on that, then you should be able to see, oh, that's the score I got. Here's the feedback that was left. Some of the feedback may be left within the rubric, so make sure you expand the rubric and look in the rubric categories. Pardon? Yeah, it'll be done by tonight. All right, any other questions? Okay. All right, so it's where we started. So this is a caterpillar. This is from a sphinx hawk moth. So this is the caterpillar here. You can see a little gripping onto here, but it happens to look a little strange here. And so what, that's, what's going on here? And this is a defensive strategy. A defensive strategy, which we focus on here, where the idea here is that, maybe this caterpillar looks a little bit like a snake, a viper, for example, a viper that's nearby. Now, why would that potentially be useful for a caterpillar? Well, what things eat caterpillars? Well, birds, Well, birds, what things potentially could attack birds and eat them if they get too close? And those are these vipers, these snakes. So, there's this, well, maybe if I look like a viper and the viper eats the birds and the birds then have some avoidance behavior of the vipers, then they'll also have an avoidance behavior of the caterpillars that look like the vipers. So that's the basic idea behind how mimicry could potentially drive this sort of defensive signaling. So mimicry, a resemblance between an organism and another object, possibly another organism. So when we talk about mimicry, we're going to be using two words often, model and mimic. So the model is what is being mimicked, and the mimic is the thing that is doing the mimicry. So the caterpillar is the mimic, the snake is the model, and then there's this third party, the predator, that we don't often talk as much about, but they're driving the whole thing. So, if it wasn't for the bird, then there would be no relationship between the caterpillar and the snake. But because there's this third party that has a relationship to both, this sort of trophic connection between the snake and the bird and the caterpillar sets up an opportunity for the caterpillar to start mimicking information that would normally be associated with the snake, the viper. So that's the idea behind mimicry, but it's that's sort of a very basic and very coarse-grained perspective. And it turns out there's a whole lot of mimicry, and it's not only defensive. We're not going to cover even a little bit of it here in this class. We're going to zoom in on two in particular, but I just want you to know that when we talk about mimicry, then there's defensive mimicry, in which we're going to focus on two examples of defensive mimicry. There's aggressive mimicry, there's reproductive mimicry, and unfortunately, most of these mimicry ideas are named after people who wrote about them. And so unfortunately, they're not named after something that is easy to remember. They're named after people's names. So you have to keep on, like, what's the difference between Batesian and Brouwerian mimicry or Gilbertian mimicry and so on and so forth. And so you just almost have to know the history and, behind that. But the idea here is that mimicry at least has really captured the imagination of behavioral ecologists or proto-behavioral ecologists for years. And so in this class, we are going to focus on the two kind of classic versions of mimicry from Bates and Mueller. And so these are mimicry that came out of the 1800s. So these are very similar types of mimicry. And so that's part of the reason why we like to learn them too, is to make sure we can tell the difference between them. And so this Muellerian mimicry, so a mnemonic you can use for this is like, well, which one's Muellerian? Muellerian's the one where M is for match or for mutualism or for merge. The idea here is you have these two individuals. Now, these are individuals that, again, remember, there's a predator that I have not put on this page here. But imagine there's something that might want to eat a wasp, might want to eat something like this up here. And so we often think about the wasps as predators themselves. We're talking about the wasps' predators, the predators that would eat wasps. And so in Muellerian mimicry, the idea here is that two different species of wasp may end up looking similar. Now, this assumes, and I put down here, both of these actually assume that predator avoidance is driven by learning. It's not driven by an innate avoidance. So the idea here is that if a predator has to have experience with wasps, then it may take some time for it to learn that, oh, that thing that stung me, that is an unpalatable prey. I never want to try to eat that wasp again. It may take four or five experiences with, getting stung by a wasp before the predator learns that that wasp is something to avoid. And so because of that, then it's actually beneficial for all of the wasps to share the same signals, to share the same cues, because that way you all get to pay the sampling cost. So like if this wasp had yellow and black stripes and this other wasp had, blue and red polka dots or something like that, then you'd have to, the predator would have to eat four or five of these to learn the black and yellow stripes, and then four or five of these to learn the red and blue polka dots. But if they both share the same, then as the predator is learning from one, it's actually learning about the other as well. So the idea here is that that Mueller came up with is that if there are several unpalatable species that have the ability to display, express very similar signals, then it'll be beneficial for them to converge on the same types of signals, because then that helps the that reduces the amount of experience you need with one species in order to learn that that species is unpalatable. Now, I want to emphasize here that learning is a key aspect of this. If you get rid of learning, if you say the predator has an innate avoidance of, yellow and black stripes, then at that point, there's no sampling cost. So right now, this whole thing is driven by this idea that in order for a predator to avoid this wasp, it has to have like five or six negative experiences. So if the predator has to have a bunch of negative experiences to learn to avoid the wasp, you may as well spread those out among a bunch of different species that all share the same patterns. But if a predator is born and it has this innate avoidance of this color pattern, then it doesn't have to sample. It immediately avoids that. And so at that point, there's no pressure for these two species to sort of share that sampling burden, to share in the learning process of the predator. So if you don't have learning, you don't have what's needed for this Müllerian mimicry. So that's the idea, is that learning drives this convergence into unpalatable. So two species that really can fight back, two species that a predator doesn't want to eat, they're going to start looking like each other. That's Müllerian mimicry. So M for match, these two start matching each other. Whether it's a little bit of a mutualism, M for mutualism, M for Müllerian. Flip side of that is Batesian mimicry. So here we have a bunch. So these are all, so these are flies. This here is a beetle. And so these hoverflies and a beetle, they can't fight back. I mean, there are beetles that can fight back, and we'll talk about those, but this one can't. So they are just juicy morsels. They are highly palatable. A predator eats these up, no cost to that. So they are just sitting there, sitting ducks or sitting hoverflies, as it will. And so there's nothing that they can do. And so their defense is to evolve a similar pattern as an unpalatable predator. So here you have, or sorry, unpalatable prey. So Müllerian, you've got two unpalatable prey that evolve the same signal to make learning easier for the predators. Here, this is a bluffing, B for bluff. Here, these ones are not unpalatable. They're actually something that a predator would be very happy to eat. So palatable would be something that is good to eat. Unpalatable is something that would be a bad thing to eat. So if a predator goes after the wasp, they get stung, that's bad. If they go after the hoverfly, they have a meal. So edible, I don't want to say inedible, but not a good experience, good experience. So Batesian is a bluffing, B for bluff, B for Batesian, B for bluff. Batesian mimicry is a way for palatable, juicy prey items to gain a little bit of a defensive advantage by looking like unpalatable prey. Müllerian is for unpalatable prey to make learning that they're unpalatable easier by all looking like each other. Questions about that difference, Batesian versus Müllerian mimicry? Both of them require learning. So with Batesian mimicry here as well, then if you have, there's another sort of pathway where if you kind of walk through the logic, if there is an innate avoidance of these signals by the predator, then there also will end up not being this drive for these for this process. It is possible to have innate avoidance that evolves and leads to things like this, but keep in mind, these are deceptive. So imagine what's going to happen here. If a predator has an innate avoidance of yellow and black stripes, and then suddenly all of these prey items that don't have any ability to fight back glom onto that, and they start having yellow and black stripes, what's going to happen to the informational value of yellow and black stripes? What do you think? Yep. Absolutely. It's going to decrease because of the dishonest signaling. That's exactly right. So you start out where yellow and black stripes are informative, like that's bad, yellow and black stripes. But then suddenly everybody is wearing yellow and black stripes. So now very few individuals in the population will have yellow and black stripes actually signaling that they're bad to eat. And so selective pressure will then end up making the predator pay less attention to yellow and black stripes, because now the population's got so many yellow and black stripes you can eat, then it's just better to eat them than not eat them. So again, the learning is thought to what's driving these things. All right, any questions about Mullerian or Bayesian mimicry? Yep. Yes, Mullerian is a mutualism. That's another M there. So it's beneficial for this wasp to look as much like this wasp and vice versa. All right. And so that's why we end up talking about these, both of these things together, and other forms of mimicry also contribute to this, create what we call mimicry complexes. This is why so many things look waspy, because that signal, so it's been all of these wasps that are out there that are true threats, they've converged on one signal that is very helpful to predators to know, I'm going to avoid that thing. And there are so many of those out there that they anchor that signal down to being, useful. And then these feed off of that. So that creates a positive externality for all of these species to go on to so that they can look like a wasp as well. So that's the reason why we see all of these yellow and black stripes, because, for whatever reason, that has become an honest, for, well, I don't, it's honest enough. If a predator can learn, then it will have so many bad experiences with these that it will learn to avoid these, and that creates a benefit for these. Okay. All right. So, and if you look carefully at these, I mean, you might be able to tell the difference between all of these, although, like, our PR folks in Souls, it always frustrates those of us who work on insects, because they'll say, oh, we have all these, look at all this great honeybee research. And then they'll have this image. And that's just, I don't know. It keeps happening, and we have to email them and say, that's actually not a bee. It makes us look bad. And then they have to put in another stock image. But it just shows how well mimicry works, right? You can trick these PR folks. But mimics don't have to be perfect. As long as you get a few of the key things that creates enough, uncertainty in the predator, then a predator will move on to something that doesn't have that ambiguity. Okay. All right. So going back to this example, does this actually fit Batesian or Mullerian mimicry? Because if we look at this thing here, it doesn't actually look that close to this thing here. And is the learning pathway isn't quite clear that this bird is going to have enough negative experiences with vipers that it's going to end up learning, if it meets a viper, that's probably it meets its end. So it doesn't feel like this quite fits the kind of Batesian mimicry that you would expect. It feels like it's of the two we've learned, it seems like it's closest to Batesian mimicry because it is a palatable prey item, this caterpillar. It would be great for this bird to eat, the squirrel cuckoo to eat. But it then, mimics, it creates a signal that ends up causing a bird to be less likely to eat it. So it feels like Batesian mimicry, but doesn't quite fit that. Well, there was this really nice paper back in 2010 that studied these tropical complexes of these caterpillars, these specific caterpillars, and the way they look, and showed that they don't fit either Batesian or Mullerian patterns here. So they don't fit either one of those. And so it ends up being kind of a new form of mimicry. So let's look into that. So this is another example of one of these. So this is a caterpillar that it's just opened. It's, you know, so it was in this leaf shelter. And then the scientist came in and pulled the leaf. So it silks the leaf together here. So you can see the silk, it kind of glues the leaf into a little shelter here. And the scientist comes through and opens that up. And you see the back end of this caterpillar. And a second later, you see the front end here. And you see, ah, these eye spots. Well, okay, so that's kind of scary, these eye spots, but they're very different than the eye spots that we just saw. And when you look at that, you're like, oh, that's weird. But what is it? You know, like, it doesn't look like the snake we just saw, right? So it seems effective, but it's, you know, but why is it effective? And then if you look across, you see all of these different, so here's the caterpillar examples. And there's like a huge diversity in all of these eye spots. I mean, they clearly look like, you know, snake-like things, but it's really hard to figure out what's the model here. And it's not just the caterpillars. You can also look across the pupae. The pupae themselves, you know, look, so these little chrysalises and things like that. So these things also get these like eye spots. And, you know, here, here, down here. So they all seem to be going for kind of a similar cartoon look, but you really can't place what they are here. And so when they looked across these, they realized that, you know, these are so different. It appears like the predators that potentially could eat these things, they tested them and they could show that they have an innate avoidance of these patterns. So the predators don't need any experience with these patterns to avoid these patterns. It is innate. So it's not learned. So that already doesn't seem to fit either of these mimicry patterns. And then there are way more mimics. So the harmless, immobile, edible caterpillars than the models. You just cannot find models that match up these things. It's just, there's just huge diversity of these mimics. And so there doesn't appear to be any selective pressure for the patterns to converge. There almost seems to be pressure for divergence here. So, it doesn't really fit either of these things where you're converging on one pattern. So, so then that raises the question of like, if you have a mimic that's not converging on a model, then for that one particular mimic, is it an honest signal to other insect-eating birds? And I think it should be clear that it's probably not, because it's a signal of what? Like if there's no model for this mimic, then what could a bird learn? It'll never experience a negative experience with that particular pattern. So it's a little confusing how it could be maintained if we just focus on that one particular caterpillar. So so then you have to say, well, then what might be happening here? Why, you know, on the flip side of that, why might there be selection against convergence? Why might there be selection for diversity? And I think this ends up being the exception to the learning rules that we talked about for Bayesian and Mullerian mimicry that kind of proves the rule, is that this giant complex has managed to diversify. And by existing in its giant, ambiguous, diverse combination, they've created enough ambiguity to freak out predators enough that there doesn't need to be a true model. Like it actually helps that all of these caterpillars don't look like each other. It seems to be that when they have these diverse patterns that can't be learned, but kind of share some, you know, core features, if there's enough of them, then that ends up being something that actually can be picked up on through an innate avoidance. So it's this anti-Mullerian, anti-Bayesian mimicry that is all about innate avoidance, but that what makes it work is the diversity that we have here. So the diversity in the complex is what, in this particular case, seems to be allowing the complex to exist, which is completely different than over here, where the convergence upon one particular pattern is what's keeping the complex together. This is all about exploiting learning costs of the predator, and this is all about preventing. This is something that can't be learned because there's so much diversity there, and because the predator can't learn that one particular pattern is a bluff, then it ends up avoiding all of them innately. I don't know. It's just very interesting to see how these mimicry complexes can come together. So that's mimicry, the defensive mimicry. So any questions about that? So the key thing that, I mean, this is just kind of, again, an exception that I'm trying to put out here to prove the rule. The key thing I want you to remember is the Mullerian and the Batesian mimicry. Those are like the cores of any animal behavior class. You learn those two at least. So make sure we know Mullerian and Batesian. Okay. We're going to find at the end of this lecture that there's three ways that we can be defensive. The first way is to avoid detection, and mimicry provides one way to avoid detection. Blend in this case, blend in to something dangerous as opposed to just blending in. That's kind of this version of mimicry. Now we can translate that to, well, okay, we'll just, yeah, so before I get ahead of myself, let's do one of these. Now that we've talked about the two types of mimicry that I want to make sure that you remember coming out of this class. So multiple choice. All right, so which form of defensive mimicry is when a palatable species, a species that has no other defenses, mimics an unpalatable model where the unpalatable species has significant defenses that would make it unlikely to be eaten otherwise. So when does palatable mimic unpalatable? Is that A, Batesian, B, Mullerian, C, Dobsonian, or D, Wasmanian mimicry? So go ahead and lock in your answers. Try to remember that mnemonic I gave you. And so a hint here is that this is deceptive. So deceptive signaling here. So the palatable is trying to signal something that it does not have. So it's trying to pretend like it's unpalatable. So it is not, it is sort of lying about its identity. So if you remember the mnemonic, then it should help you towards one of these. All right, we'll go ahead and close that in maybe 10 seconds. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close now. All right, so we had nobody for C, D, and E, which is good because there's no E, and I didn't talk about C or D. A few for B, and most for A. And I was looking for A, Batesian. So idea here is that the palatal model was bluffing. It was, its palatability. So it actually was palatable, but it was signaling that it wasn't. That's a bluff. So B for bluff, B for Batesian mimicry. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, great. All right, so if we talk about signaling defensive capabilities, there's a couple other terms I want to make sure we have available to us. So these are all cases where, so I've already seen these. These are all honest signals. These are all things you would not want to eat. In some cases, would not want to touch. So these are signals that that are produced by animals that have either internal poisons, so poisonous, can't eat it, or toxins, you don't want to touch it, and so or venoms. And so in case here, so we got poison, toxin, and venom in all of these examples here. So none of these are ones that you'd want to eat. So this type of highly colorful signaling that correlates with the ability of the animal to cause a digestive issue or possibly lead to even death, that we call that aposematism, or aposematic signaling. So it's the use of warning coloration to inform predators that an animal is poisonous, venomous, or otherwise dangerous. So This is saying that it does have the inter, it will possibly die in the interaction, but it will take the predator with it. So the predator can learn that very quickly. So aposematic signaling. So very, that's, you know, bright colors indicating poisons. That's what we're talking about there. That's that term. So we notice that, you know, there are, you know, there's this like interesting convergences here. Like this black and yellow stripes, maybe that's mimicking these wasps, or, you know, maybe it's mimicking a coral snake because this looks an awful lot like a coral snake. So maybe the reason why we see black and yellow so often is a convergence on that being an easy pattern for predators to learn as something to avoid. So a lot of mimicry going on here as well. All right, so aposematic signaling, great example here that you see in Arizona, these lubbers. So these Western horse lubber grasshoppers here, so these giant orthopterans. You know, sometimes they're the ones in southern Arizona are also called Mexican generals, is a common name they use down there. So they're beautiful animals. And if you spread their wings out, they've got this really bright red wing on the inside here. Very, very toxic. Do not eat these things. This, despite them being these large animals that look like they'd be, you know, take a juicy bite out of them, but they are extremely toxic. And this has become such a useful signal that, so these are orthopterans. So orthopterans, you know, katydids, grasshoppers, and crickets, they are saltatorial. They jump. That is how they get away. That is how they survive. These ones have basically lost the ability to jump. They are so bad at jumping. If you find them in the middle of the desert, you go behind them and you kind of, you know, you just go, oh, wow, I'm going to pick up this grasshopper. You get close to it and it will try to leap away. 9 times out of 10, it lands on its side. It's just really bad at jumping. So it's amazing that a grasshopper would be so bad at hopping. And the thought is that that nothing, you know, that none of the possible predators will end up going after this thing because it is just so bright. And when they do jump, when they do actually get a little bit in flight, and you see these red wings flapping again, it's a beautiful sign. It's really conspicuous, easy for a predator to pick up on. And that apparently works. So they've gotten so good at this defensive modality, they don't need the running away defensive modality anymore because predators just don't go after them. So a great example of aposematic signaling and these lubbers, these Mexican generals, as they call it here, which might not be a good term, but it is the term I think that they use down there. All right, so aposematic signaling. Yeah, other examples of you know, similar things going on here is crypsis. So you know, aposematic signaling is you're trying to be seen. Crypsis is you're trying not to be seen. So you know, there's these examples here where you've got again another grasshopper that is blending into the leaf. It's got these nice patterns that really match the venous patterns here of the leaf. Dead leaf moths. So these look like leaves, but that's a moth right there. There's a moth there that's on the stump here. So it's great there. You know, walking sticks. So walking sticks not only are going to look like a stick, but if you sort of freak them out a little bit, or you know, a little bit of air or wind goes by them, they do this little shaky thing. So if you've ever seen, if you ever haven't done this before, if you ever are up next to a walking stick, you kind of blow across them a little bit and they'll wiggle like they're a twig that has been just blown across in the wind. So they have behavioral mimicry of what plants do when you have certain stimulus. And so these are all ways for them to blend into the background. So so just general, we call that crypsis, and that includes hiding. So an animal that goes and hides under something, that's we view that under crypsis. But if you're specifically have a expressing a morphological phenotype or a behavioral phenotype that makes you look like something else, then that form of crypsis is what we call camouflage. So the standard sort of form there. So camouflage, form of crypsis, lots of different examples of that. Okay, so assume no questions on that, but you know, and you know, you mimicry can be folded in here too. So, you know, trying to blend in to, you know, like, so this would be another example of mimicry. So mimicry doesn't have to be Batesian or Mullerian mimicry. Here you can be blending in. So this is a palatable species trying to be blend into a non-palatable leaf. It's non-palatable because, you know, if you're a carnivore, maybe you have no interest in eating the leaf, but you do have an interest in eating the caterpillar. So it's not that the leaf bites back, it's that the leaf is not of value to you. So it's trying to look like something that has no value to the predator that would eat it. Okay. So, you know, this is a really fun example of camouflage. So there, this is a patu. So common patu here. So this is a night bird that if there's also things called like tawny frog mouths that are that used to be thought to be kind of more closer related, but they're still in some of the same category of birds on the other side of the world. Really cool bird, very conspicuous at that big yellow eye there, right? But otherwise, you see it's kind of bark colored here. Well, so it pretends to be a tree stump during the day. So here's a real tree stump. Here's the patu. So it's pretty cool that, like, if you happen to catch it with its head down during the day and you kind of get a little bit close to it, it will very slowly lift its head up and close its eyes. Like, not like it won't snap it, it just sort of slowly does that and closes its eyes. And then, oh, look, it's just a tree stump. So another example here. So here's the real tree, and you see it's sort of sitting right on the top of where this is broken off, and so it fills in nicely. So it looks like that. So it's itself a predator at night, but there are birds of prey that look for it during the day, and this is a great way for it to hide. So that's cool, but the other crazy thing about this is it's the way it reproduces has also been shaped by mimicry. Because if this is how it has to sit during the day, well, how the heck is it going to maintain a nest, right? So what has it done with that? Well, they lay their eggs in a similar way. So they will find a broken tree branch and they only lay one egg. So they're you know, so how many offspring they can have has been constrained by this mimicry process, by this defensive process, where they only lay one egg at a time. They find the top, usually it's a knot in a tree or it's a broken branch, and they lay the egg and they just place it inside. They're like a cup. And then they'll go and then they incubate. So they'll sit on top of it like this. And so that's, you know, and so then they just cap off the egg. So they become a little protective cap on the top of their nest, where their nest is just the tree right here. So I think it's a pretty cool example there. So the patu, really cute bird. Look up videos of it. It's just a really neat bird. Okay, so moving on. Any questions about the mimicry stuff? We're gonna move on to gradually, you know, higher forms of aggression. Okay, so the other, you know, so that's avoid being detected. The other way you can defend yourself is to evade capture. If you think there's a pretty good chance that you will eventually be approached by a predator, then being able to give yourself a head start is valuable. And so, you know, there are various examples of startle behavior. So a sudden production of movement, sound, or another stimulus that distracts a predator. So there are these eye spots down here. And normally this, this moth, closes its wings up so those eye spots aren't there. But if a predator comes by, it'll open those up. And then suddenly you got these two eyes staring you in the face. They'll kind of look like owl eyes. They kind of look like predatory eyes themselves. And if that even gives them a half second, then they can fly off and then potentially get away. So that's what we mean a startle response, is to do something that is a little weird that gives the predator pause. It doesn't completely generate avoidance, but it just gives them a little bit of time so they can get away. So-called startle behavior. But of course, this startle behavior is co-opting, you know, there's mimicry involved here as well. So a lot of mimicry in all this signaling stuff. All right, so that's one way to evade capture. The other way to evade capture is through vigilance, and you see this a lot in social animals. So prairie dogs, you know, if one of them sees a potential predator, then they can make an alarm call, which will alert oftentimes other related prairie dogs. So the idea behind vigilance is that if an animal or a group of animals devotes some of their time to keeping an eye out for predators, Then you end up seeing, that is another way you can the defensive way. There are these, I can't think of the name of the birds right now. It's a common bird in Phoenix, but they always move around in pairs. And so if you like see them in the backyard, then towhees that where the if I look out of my backyard, I'll see one of them out foraging on the ground, and there'll be another one sitting on a wall looking down at it. And if I like get close to the glass to look outside, the one that's looking down will start calling, and it calls down to the one that's on the ground. And so they always move around in pairs. There's always one on the lookout and the other one doing the foraging, and the one that's doing the foraging will bring food up to the one on the lookout. So that's another example of vigilance. So you're taking time away from other things like foraging in order to keep an eye out for predators. So, and that helps you evade capture, because if you can do that, if you can give enough warning, then you can get out of the way. And that's what this reading assignment for this unit is about. And they're able to show that the tail flagging, which is an alarm call for these predators or for these prairie dogs when there's predators around, is actually an honest signal of vigilance to the predator. So if you, they'll basically, they think that these prairie dogs or these ground squirrels in this article here will occasionally give these their own version of this tail flagging, which is a little bit like an alarm call, even when there aren't predators that are obviously around. And that's making them more conspicuous to the predator, which seems like it's costly. But these experiments show that it, like stotting, which will be like the next slide here, it make the predator was less likely to approach the ground squirrels if it sees a squirrel that's doing this tail flagging. So it's kind of like if you've already been noticed, if you're already been flagged as kind of sus, then in that case, you're probably going to be less likely to carry out whatever that thing was that you thought you could kind of keep on the DL. So that's kind of what's going on here, is that if they're doing the tail flagging already, then the predator knows they're going to see me, they're going to alert everyone, and they're going to run off. It is not worth my energy to try for this. So it appears like this signaling is not only signaling to the other ground squirrels, but it's also signaling to the predator itself, which I think is kind of cool. So you can read about that in that example. And so this, like I said, is very similar to the stotting example we started the course with, where here, this very conspicuous way of running is actually signaling more to the predator than to other prey. And it's saying to the predator that, look, I have the ability to run away from you. And so if you go after me, it's going to be a losing fight for you. And so you may as well go after something that can't do this. All right. So those are different ways to evade capture. Any questions about those things before we work to the fight? No, we're going to finish up with the fight back. Okay. All right. So escape or fight back. So if you have the option to fight back, then you have to decide, do I fight or do I flee? And that's a very interesting behavior that we can study. So, now we're in this area of agonistic behavior. So that's any behavior related to fighting between the same species. So when you hear us talk about agonistic behavior, then that's within species. And that's very different than antagonistic, because that's an interaction between different species where one organism benefits at the expense of another. Hunting, parasitism, defense against these. So if you're hunting, yeah, violence might be involved in hunting. That makes sense. There are trophic reasons for that. Within species, violence is a little weirder, because you usually don't eat within species. Cannibalism is very rare. And so when you see violence within species that actually escalates all the way to violence, that's pretty rare. And when you see things that are kind of ramps up to them, then that indicates there might be some interesting social interaction going on. So that's why we have two different terms for this, agonism and antagonism. Okay, so how do you figure out, and we're focusing a lot here, I want to kind of talk about both of these, but how do you figure out if you fight or flee? And if you're in kind of a standoff with another animal that also can fight or flee, then how do you break the symmetry of who's going to be the fighter and who's going to flee? So we're going to talk about those examples here. So this is an example here with these stock-eyed flies, for example. Here's some jumping spiders. So like I was mentioning here, animals will tend to avoid escalating through aggression within their species whenever possible. It's very rarely do you see, a fight to the death within species. So there's a lot of these ritualized aggressive signals which that seem to correlate with how animals make a decision as to whether they move forward and try to take a resource or back off and allow that resource to be taken. And so these stock-eyed flies, it turns out that how big these stalks are, these eye stalks are, tend to be a social signal that you can use to predict the outcome of these aggressive interactions. And there's some similar things that go on with these jumping spiders that stretch their legs out as far as possible when they approach a potential competitor. So in this case, we refer to these as correlated asymmetries. So this is an example where the phenotypic expression is a direct correlate to the likely winner of an outcome. And so based on that, if you're the stock-eyed fly, if you've got these tiny little stalks and you approach a fly with these big stalks, then in that particular case, that tends to predict you're probably going to lose. And you use that asymmetry that is correlated with the outcome as a way to predict, okay, oh, this is their stalks are bigger than mine. I'm going to get out of the way and allow them to take this resource. I'm going to fly off and try to find some other territory to mate in, for example. So that's what I mean by a correlated asymmetry. And we should be familiar with this because we experience this whenever we drive. So if you're approaching an intersection and there's a stop sign, not a stoplight, but a stop sign, then you stop there. If two individuals stop at the same time, then you have to remember these asymmetries that we've put into the driving rules. And if you both stop at the stop sign at the same time, the one on the right gets the right of way. If you like say, oh, there's some ambiguity there, then it ends up being like almost random. And whoever ends up aggressing into the intersection ends up being the one that kind of wins. So we have stoplights to create these unambiguous asymmetries between these two directions to say that if you're moving down one direction, then the red light direction, it's going to be very costly for them to move into that intersection because everyone in the green light direction, no one's going to even slow down. It's sort of agreed upon by this third party asymmetry by what's going on to the stoplight. So we call that a correlated equilibrium. So that's the reason why it ends up being beneficial for you to follow the color of the stoplight. Because if you try to follow a different color, if you try to go on red, then in most cases, that's going to be very bad for you. So it's beneficial to follow the color. And this is another example of a correlated asymmetry. I am in the red lane, they're in the green lane. I'm just going to follow that pattern. And then I trust that this will eventually will change and I will eventually have an opportunity to be in a green. And that's what keeps things moving. But for that particular interaction, I follow this. I either go when I'm green and I'm stop when I'm red. That's my correlated asymmetry. It's correlated to the likely outcome. You go on red, it's likely to be very bad for you. So that's one way we break these and figure out who fights. In this case, green fights and stop doesn't. But then there's also uncorrelated asymmetries. So there can be two animals that have no obvious, one animal is not obviously stronger than the other animal. There might be differences in the way they look, but none of those differences correlate to whether they would win the outcome. And in these cases, we refer that they would say that oftentimes these contests are resolved by uncorrelated asymmetries. So there are other asymmetries not correlated to the animal. Like for example, if this animal is moving into this range where this animal is already on, then there is an asymmetry there that this is this animal's home range and not this animal's range. So that uncorrelated asymmetry there breaks the symmetry between them, where the one that's on the home range will be more likely to win the fight than the one that is coming in. So that's another way you can break these symmetries. So correlated and uncorrelated asymmetries. So whenever we see these examples where two animals come up together and we notice sometimes animals back off and sometimes animals fight, those are the questions we ask. Those are the hypotheses we test. Is there a correlated asymmetry or is there an uncorrelated asymmetry that breaks the symmetry between these, that explains why this animal tends to fight and this animal tends to not? So we look for those. So these are effectively hypotheses that we look for. How's the uncorrelated? So here, there's nothing about the animals that tells you who is likely to win the fight. But it happens to be that this animal has a home range and this animal's roving. And it is their history that actually predicts the outcome of the fight, not the animals themselves. Whereas in the stock-eyed fly case or the jumping spider case, in this case, this is a correlated asymmetry where the flies, I should have had another stock-eyed fly here, but the idea here is these flies vary in the length of their eye stalks. And they actually sort of measure each other. So they'll go up to each other, they'll bump into each other, and they'll say, okay, yep, your stalks are shorter than mine. And so in this case, we could actually predict who's going to be the winner of this outcome by looking at a difference in their body expression. So it's a correlated asymmetry. There's a way in which the stock-eyed flies are different that correlates to the defensive outcome. Whereas in the cat example, these cats may have differences, but these differences, if I look at a bunch of different competitions between cats, it's not like the black and white cats always win. So these two cats, I actually can't tell which one's going to win. But when I look at the history, then I see, oh, but it turns out that it's always the one that's on the home range. That's the one that tends to win. So that's an uncorrelated asymmetry. It's like an asymmetry in their past. It's not an asymmetry in themselves. Well, just their history. Like this cat happens to, it's protecting this range. So it happens to be in this range. So like if someone comes to your house, then that's your house. And so like regardless of whether that person has, is stronger or looks a particular way or whatever, the key thing is not about that. The key thing is that it's not their house and it's your house. So where you live really depends on who's going to win that interaction. All right, so correlated and uncorrelated asymmetries. Is that any other questions about that? A general idea? We use those to sort of try to build models to try to understand the distribution of strategies we see in nature. So if you think about that, if there's no asymmetries, but what is the right balance of aggressive behavior when there's no asymmetries to determine the right roles? And so at this point, so imagine a balance here and where you've got escape on one side and fight back on the other side, then how do you figure out where this fulcrum is? So, if it's over here, then there's a high probability of fleeing. If it's over here, there's a high probability of fighting. I guess if I was thinking this about a fulcrum, maybe I should have written them the other way around because it's like we'll tip more towards that one or whatever. But the idea here is that how do you figure out what this balance is when there aren't any obvious asymmetries that you can work with? And so if you start looking at the population, then sometimes that is the hint that you need. And so that's the last case here that before we pull all these asymmetries and everything together, that I want to mention negative frequency dependent selection, which you may have heard about if you took an evolution, potentially genetics. But the idea here is the fitness of a phenotype decreases as it becomes more common. So it's frequency dependent selection. That's the fitness relates to how common it is. And then the negative is that the frequency is that it's a negative relationship there. So if everyone is a fighter, then it becomes so costly to fight that you get more the emergence of a phenotype that avoids fighting. If everyone avoids fighting, then you get the emergence of a phenotype that fights. That's this kind of idea here. So we see, we've seen that happen with the producer scrounger. That's an example of this. If everyone's a producer, there becomes a pressure for scroungers to come into play. If everyone's a scrounger, there becomes a pressure for producers. And then, you can imagine host-parasite interactions as well. If there are a bunch of hosts and no parasites, then so so you can either if there's no parasites, there's a pressure to become a parasite. But if there's so many parasites that there's no hosts, then the pressure to become a parasite becomes less, and then you find a bunch of, and so then hosts then can rebound. So you get this back and forth. So the point here is that negative frequency-dependent selection can lead to oscillations or dynamic balancing in a population. And so we can see some examples of that in here. I'll show you a left and right mouth fish case here in just a second. But now that we have all three of those concepts together, we can sort of put it, with the kind of this game theory framework behind the scenes of this so-called hawk-dove game. So I already talked about the stag hunt game. We'll finally mention briefly the prisoner's dilemma in the last lecture of the class, which again is generally a useless game when we talk about behavior. But hawk-dove tends to be something that shows up a lot. And so the idea here is you've got these two strategies, hawk, the aggressive strategy, dove, the submissive strategy. And so a hawk plays another hawk, then that is a negative outcome for both hawks, because they fight each other and it's very bad for both hawks. If a dove plays against another dove, then it's like there's a winning of possibly 10 that they just split between them. They just, let's call it even, we'll split up whatever the rewards are that we're fighting for. Just cut it even, they're not going to fight about it. If a dove plays a hawk, the dove gives everything up to the hawk. The hawk has no cost in that and gets everything. And then likewise, on the other side of it, if a hawk plays dove, again, the hawk gets everything. So if you set this up, maybe that's our hawk-dove game here. If you think about, remember we defined Nash equilibria one or two lectures ago, and it turns out there are two Nash equilibria in this system, dove-hawk and hawk-dove. So again, this drives that the key thing behind this problem is who's going to get to play hawk? So hawk-hawk is not a Nash, dove-dove is not a dove. If everybody's a dove, there's pressure for hawk to come in. If everybody's a hawk, there's pressure for a dove to come in. So the only balance is if one of them, like once you agree, you're the hawk and I'm the dove, then there will be no pressure for the dove to want to go hawk, because they go hawk and it's going to be even worse than just giving the lunch away. But then likewise, if the hawk is playing hawk against a dove, the hawk has no benefit of going dove, because then it'll split its winnings between it and the dove. So that's what it means it becomes a Nash. But then who plays which role? That's the kind of core idea here that I've been talking about in all these three examples, with the negative frequency dependence, the correlated equilibria, and the uncorrelated asymmetries. So if there are asymmetries, then whoever gets to play hawk is determined by those asymmetries. So the stock-eyed fly, whoever's got the bigger stocks, you get to be the hawk. If it's your home range, you get to be the home range. You got the green light, you get to be the hawk. So whoever's got, that asymmetry determines who gets hawk and who gets dove. The interesting case happens when there are no asymmetries. And so in that case, what it turns out, when if there's no way to say that there's like an asymmetric reason why one player should be the hawk and the other player should be the dove, then what we see in populations is a mixed equilibrium, where a fraction of the population is a hawk and a fraction of the population is a dove. Or alternatively, a fraction of an individual splits their time, sometimes being a hawk and sometimes being a dove. And this is exactly what we saw in the producer scrounger game. So this goes to that negative frequency dependent selection. So when you have no asymmetries driving behavioral roles, then the population will often drive the behavioral roles. So if you have no idea if you should be a hawk or a dove, if there's a bunch of hawks, you probably should dove. If there's a bunch of doves, you probably should hawk. And eventually that will come to either a balance or an oscillation. All right, so before I go to an example of that with these left mouth and right mouth fish, are there questions about this general framework that all of these things I claim fit underneath? So producer scrounger is a hawk dove, the stock-eyed flies is a hawk dove, and so on. Okay, so this is the general process. Imagine, you know, negative frequency dependence. What if doves can adapt to hawks? So that means that if you see a bunch of hawks, you can decide to hawk. And likewise, if there's multiple types of dove and hawk. So the idea here, you can imagine whenever the hawk has an advantage, then that will eventually lead to a dove having, so whenever you get a bunch of hawks, that will lead to it being an advantage to having a dove, to being a dove, which will lead to a bunch of doves, which will lead to an advantage of being a hawk, which will then lead to an advantage to being a dove. So this idea here that you can get oscillations where if you're player A and it's your advantage to being a hawk, then that will eventually lead to an advantage to being a dove because you'll be playing a hawk and you want to get out of these fights. So you start giving up. And at that point, once you're a dove, like, so you end up seeing this trailing that once you get beat up enough, you start fighting back. Once everybody's fighting, then eventually those who've been fighting the longest stop fighting and you get this oscillation back and forth. That's this negative frequency dependent selection. And a great example of that are these fish. So these are these two morphs of fish. So you go to this lake in Africa, there are these are cichlids. And so if you sample these fish, you'll find that some of these fish have a right opening mouth. I thought I had a zoom in, better zoomed in view of that. But some of them have kind of a small right bend in their mouth and some have a left bend in their mouth. And so if you look here, the kind of lips of this fish are tilting a little bit toward you right now. And the lips of that fish that's in the other orientation are also kind of tilted for you. So they have this left bend and the right bend. And if you scoop up a bunch of these fish, it's very easy to score them, whether they're a left bending or right bending fish. And, you know, what do they do? What do they eat? Well, they eat scales off of other fish. So here's an example. So there's this slow speed video here of this cichlid coming in, and it is going to lean over and grab that scale. It uses its left leaning mouth to eat the scale off of this other fish. And that other fish responds by tilting a certain way and trying to run off that way. So if you have a bunch of left mouth fish, what happens is eventually you get the host that they're parasitizing, the fish that they're eating scales off of. That host, eventually it starts to learn that if there's a bunch of left mouth fish, whenever it gets a little bit of motion on that side of itself, it snaps there preemptively and it can either fight back or get away. So when you're a left mouth, when there's a bunch of left mouth fish, it becomes advantageous to be a right mouth fish because the host, the prey, the host here will start responding to the fish that is in excess. And so you would predict here that you're going to get oscillations where you come, you know, the first year you come, you get a left mouth. Whenever you fish for these cichlids, you get left mouth. And then you come back the next year, you're going to get right mouth. Come back the next year, you get left mouth, and so on. That would be the prediction. And so they, you know, so this is basically that prediction here. The idea here that you're going to get hosts that fight back and they create an advantage to be the other type of parasite. And then that will then switch. So then the hosts fight back a different way. And then that leads to, so you get a left mouth advantage and then a right mouth advantage and the left mouth advantage and so on. So to test this, they actually went and they did exactly what I said there. They went from, this is 1980 all the way up through 1990. And they just sampled the cichlids that were in the lake. And what they found is in 1980, you had a bunch of the right mouth. And then in 1983, you had a bunch of the left mouth and it went back and forth. And it turns out that it does that. You can go there today, and if you keep sampling them, you find that they're constantly oscillating this way. So this appears to be a negative frequency dependent selection driving an oscillation, a constant oscillation in this population, because you're seeing the interaction between the parasite and its host, the host fighting back against the parasite adjusting to keep the host from being able to fight back, and this going on and on and on till the end of time. So that's what you can get with negative frequency dependent selection. All right, questions about that example? I think it's pretty cool to see that dynamic population, the fact that you see these behaviors. It's like the mouths are constantly switching. Okay. So yeah, oscillations over time. All right, so that's an example of an aquatic arms race, and we generally use that term whenever we see oscillations like this as an arms race. So you see a bunch of arms races in nature between predators and prey, between parasites and hosts. So it's a co-evolutionary arms race where the existence of both species that both can adapt to the presence of the other creates the constantly they're chasing their tail, and that just keeps the population never settles down. It's always kind of oscillating around where you might expect it to settle down. That's the outcome of this arms race. Okay. And these arms races, you could argue that we started with an informational arms race where the diversity in these patterns is sort of a response to predators that might get wise to these things. And so it's possible that this growth in diversity of these patterns is actually the outcome of a similar arms race where you started out with a little bit of diversity and then the predator caught on, and then you got more diversity and so on. And then as the predator catches on, you get more and more. So you get an escalation behavior that comes out of it. All right, so wrapping up here, what have we talked about here? So we said that one core way to defend yourself is to just avoid detection. So you don't have to defend yourself. And there's crypsis, there's camouflage, there's mimicry, there's hiding behaviors. Those are all ways that you can do that. If it's impossible to completely avoid detection, you need a way to escape and evade, or evade capture. So that's where we talked about startling behavior that slows the predator down. Then there's vigilance, where you can actually then, if you pay attention to where the predators are, then you can maybe pre-escape to give yourself extra time. And then if you have the ability to escape, if you can signal that ability to the predator, then the predator might pick up on that and that might save you. Now, if that is impossible to totally escape all of these aggressive interactions, then you can fight back. And what are different ways you can fight back? Well, you can just be unpalatable. You can have a sting, you can have a toxin, you can be poisonous, or you can choose not to fight back when the costs of losing are worse than the costs of giving up. And that kind of leads us to our hawk-dove game. So how do you decide whether you're a hawk or a dove? Are there asymmetries that are on the animal or in the animal's history that explain whether it should be a hawk or a dove? And if not, then do we expect to see mixed equilibria where you get populations where some of the population play one thing, the other population play the other thing, and they might even oscillate. And so it kind of leads all the way down through there. So that's what I want you to take away from this lecture here. So any questions? All right, well, that's all we got. So in that case, we'll close here with one last clicker. And then I think the next unit is on sex. So we will acknowledge the presence of sex in the next couple of lectures. So clicker question here. We'll say, okay. So in the case of a stock-eyed fly, where two stock-eyed flies come up to each other and measure the length of their stalks before deciding whether to run away or fight, Is that an example of a correlated asymmetry or an uncorrelated asymmetry? So just the word correlated or uncorrelated or some approximation of those two words. And that's all I've got you. All I've got for you. Yeah, just type in correlated or uncorrelated, whichever one you think that example of the stock-eyed flies comparing their stocks. And answers like Moose and Hamilton rule will get you a zero for today. Yep. Yeah.